Hi everyone, and welcome to this session that is going to be a panel discussion on strengths and the limitations of effective field theory. And the key goal of this session is trying to pinpoint what are the features or constraints that quantum gravity should satisfy at low energies, independent of the specific approach to quantum gravity that one is looking at. Since here in the audience there are people from different communities and background, let me start by introducing in detail the panel. So we have John Donoghue, who is, as you have understood, a leading expert in effective field theory, and is particularly famous for his calculations on quantum corrections to general relativity, and in particular to the Newtonian potential. Andrew Tolley is known for his work on massive gravity, effective field theory, and is a leading expert on positivity bounds in effective field theory. Miguel Montero is a junior leader at IFT Madrid, and is a leading expert in swamp plant constraints, and he has been really a driving force for pushing the program in the past years. Carlo Rovelli is one of the founders and a leading expert in loop quantum gravity, and in particular, phenomenology in particular related to black holes. And Fernando Quevedo from Cambridge and the former director of the Abdul Salam International Center for Theoretical Physics is a string theorist and famous for his work on string compactifications and moduli stabilization, but also for his work at the interface between string theory, effective field theory, and cosmology. The structure of the panel will be the following. So we will start with opening statements from each of the panelists, 5 minutes each at most. And then we will continue with a discussion among the panelists, discussing their opening statement, trying to answer the question above, and if there is any disagreement, trying to pinpoint where the disagreement comes from. And finally, we will open the discussion to the audience, so also taking questions and having an open discussion with everyone here. Okay, so at this point we can start with the opening statement, and I pass the switcher to. Can you please pass this to John, such that he can switch slides?
It works. Yeah. So my answer to that key question that's on the first slide is of course, that all quantum theories of gravity should satisfy an effective field theory at low energies with coefficients that are well defined by the fundamental theory. However, it is interesting, I find it interesting to try to think about what could go wrong in a more general sense. And this is not really just the effective field theory, this is all field theories. All field theories are based on a set of assumptions that we seem to see experimentally, but there are limits to our knowledge about that. So, for example, we believe that the world is four-dimensional, that it's smooth. We see it looking smooth at present energies. They satisfy various symmetry properties, Lorentz invariants, the axioms of quantum field theory. We are assuming are satisfied. The techniques of quantum mechanics. And so there is a framework which we have, which we try to fit all of our theories into. Now, some of those things could go wrong. An example of something about even four dimensions and that could go wrong is if space-time was not as simply, it had extra dimensions that were not as simply connected. So in a 2D analogy, if we had this piece of paper where the 2D being the equivalent of our 4D space-time, and these two points here are very close together. Normally, the uncertainty principle would tell you that things are localized in this small region here if they're due to high energies. But in fact, they could have a bridge between the two places, and this point and that point could be connected. So, you know, there are ways that even the simplest of our assumptions could go wrong. And the axioms of field theory include causality, and causality seems to be violated if you have extra time derivatives in your fundamental Lagrangian, so in things like quadratic gravity. Higher derivative theory seem to violate causality, so that could go wrong. The symmetries that we see could not be there at low energies. You know, it could be like on an example that was used earlier today was on a lattice. The lattice is not rotationally invariant, it's not translation invariant, but the symmetries emerge at low energies. Solids are not rotationally or translationally invariant on small scales, but they are on large scales. And even quantum physics has some limitations where it's not been tested in some of the experiments that are going on now on superpositions of macroscopic bodies are tests that could, in fact, reveal changes in our understanding of quantum mechanics. So all of our field theories could go astray. The effective field theory doesn't suffer much more liability than other theories. They're all effective field theories. It just is usual quantum field theory without much extra assumption, with a little bit of clear thinking about the scales involved, and I highlighted the uncertainty principle in that. And it just involves the assumption of general, besides the other things, general covariance and the low energy degrees of freedom that we seem to have. So when I think of what goes wrong with the general relativistic effective field theory, I think of what goes wrong with all theories. And they all could go wrong. In the case of trying to use these theories, we sometimes make mistakes, and so I phrase it that we fail our quantum field theories. This has happened in effective field theories before. I mean, there was a stage where in the soft collinear effective field theory, they couldn't reproduce the Reggie behavior of QCD until our understanding deepened on the use of Glauber modes. Okay, so it's just a technical development that happened that it suddenly advanced the theory. We have troubles in a lot of aspects of quantum field theory. We don't know how to do the asymptotic series. The study of resurgence is going on. We don't know how to do usual field theory in curved space-time with great accuracy, precision. If you ask an axiomatic field theorist if are there particles in curved space-time, it's hard to answer that in general. And so many of the things that are troublesome are probably things that we just need to understand better. But it's also true, I mean, on a more optimistic point of view, that gravity could be the case that is the breakthrough for many of these questions. Gravity has the feature that it doesn't get screened easily. It doesn't get screened, period. Whereas all the other interactions that we test experimentally do get screened. And so it could be that that's where some of the new physics that we'd like to find beyond our usual quantum field theories will be seen. You know, there's a frontier which I've written there is macroscopicity, which I can't even pronounce, but the idea that we have not tested quantum mechanics on macroscopic scales beyond a certain limit. And there's no reason why there couldn't be nonlinearities. There might be decoherence may come in when we're dealing with classical objects. So the gravity may be a special case that allows us to make progress. So that's the optimistic viewpoint. And let me stop my personal comments there.
Okay, thank you, John. So can you switch to the next slide? And then we have Andrew. I just have one slide with your name on.
Oh. That's my slide.
Yes.
So I didn't do my homework and prepare any slides. So I'm just going to say a few little comments. So one thing I know just was mentioned. So in I've also worked on theories of gravity, such as massive gravity, where things change at large distances. I think most of the discussion so far has had in the mindset of thinking about new physics at high energies. But sometimes you have situations where there could be new physics at large distances as well. And the effective field theory you're dealing with actually may only be intermediate. So for example, in the case of massive gravity, GR is actually an approximation that occurs at intermediate scales that may be modified at high energy scales, but may also be modified in the infrared. So just to sort of comment about our thinking about the use of effective field theories, sometimes they're only valid over a range of scales at both ends. So in terms of things that we expect effective field theories to satisfy at low energies, obviously I've talked about positivity bounds. There's been a lot of progress on those, and that's great. But now just to sort of turn it round, it's also in some sense very disappointing because all of the statements made are about 2-2 scattering amplitudes, which is really not much. So essentially, if you think about a tree level, what does a 2-2 scattering amplitude get influenced by? It's the quartic interaction and the cubic squared. And that's all you're probing about your theory. And of course, at loop level, other stuff comes in, but all that's suppressed because loops have to be small, otherwise you can't do your calculation. So our current constraints on effective field theories of those that come from, say, positivity bound or S-matrix bootstrap arguments, whilst there's been a huge amount of progress and it's very impressive, it's really also very little in some sense in terms of constraining the full form of the theory. And that's certainly something, you know, and this is a criticism of the S-matrix program that, in fact, if you look at the old stuff, lots of stuff was stated about the analyticity and properties of 2-2 scattering amplitudes, and then you'll ask, well, what about 3-3 scattering? Essentially nothing. There's like 4 papers, and they're all terrible, no answer. So it'd be very interesting to get much more progress on that. As a limitation of those ideas, at the moment, what they do is they put constraints on the irrelevant operators, which is nice, but you know the thing about EFTs is that once the corrections get big, that's also when you can't trust the EFT. So you can only trust the irrelevant operators when they're small, but the relevant ones are still the main ones. And so what we don't have through the positivity type framework or the bootstrap type framework is serious constraints on the relevant part of the Lagrangian, which is the one that's dominant. So we can't say, for example, what the form of the inflationary potential has to be from that because we can't have constraints. So that of course, is where the swampland conditions come in, but they're less rigorously proven at the moment, so that would be something that would be nice to address. So I think that's all I've got intelligent to say, so I'll pass it on.
You're next?
Yes. So I have more slides. Just some thoughts on like so when you know when the panel was proposed, they asked us to try and address some concrete questions, like for instance, what are the strengths and limitations of effective field theory in gravity? And you know, I think I kind of like I agree with John. Like they're more or less, you know, the same. Particularly when you go to the UV frontier, they're the same as without gravity. So the way I think about effective field theory, it's kind of like it's a machine that you know that implements the whatever symmetries the problem at hand might have, like the Lorentz symmetry typically, or you know some global symmetries, and parameterizes our ignorance in terms of a finite number of couplings. And it also gives you a framework to compute any observable in that effective field theory up to some UV cutoff. So you can get some machine to organize things by symmetry and then get predictions. But what it doesn't do, right, it tells you the values of what the couplings are, particularly the ones that are really relevant. They are like masses or couplings, and it also doesn't tell you the value of the cutoff. Right, so it's the effective field theory may have some general. Sometimes you can constrain its regime of validity using unitarity and stuff like that, but it doesn't really tell you in general from the bottom up what it does. And this is where, for instance, swampland ideas help. So swampland, for instance, it doesn't contradict anything that effective field theory. Computes, but it can be against effective field theory expectations. So it can give you information about these parameters of the effective field theory that might be a bit surprising depending on your point of view from the IR. So take for instance an example like the weak gravity conjecture or the distance conjecture. Weak gravity tells you that there's a mass, there's a particle whose mass is lower than its charge. Like why would there be a reason for this in from the bottom. Point of view of bottom-up effective field theory. I think it would be very nice if we could prove something like this from positivity bounds, and there's people who have tried, right? I think that's not, maybe this is a topic to talk about further, because I think that's a very, very nice target, because it's true in every string theory example that we know of, we check. Another example is the distance conjecture, which tells you that the cutoff goes exponentially with this scalar field, and so both of these things may go against effective field theory expectations, but they don't really go against effective field theory. So for instance, an example of an effective field theory expectation that might be broken by these two conjectures is, imagine you have some mass parameter in your effective field theory, like the Higgs, for instance, the Higgs mass. And typically, naive one-loop diagrams diverge, they give you corrections which are proportional to their quadratic divergences on the mass. So you would expect, you could have like effective field theory expectation that the correction to the mass is proportional to the cutoff square. But that's really not, it's a UV-sensitive thing, so it's not really computed by effective field theory. And if you have something like weak gravity conjecture, for instance, which relates the mass to the charge, you might say, oh, actually, because of weak gravity, I can trade the mass by the running of the charge, and the running of the charge is logarithmic. So things now become a bit more natural. So it maybe break a bit effective field theory expectations, but not much. And a reasoning like this, for instance, was applied in a paper by Isabel García-García, Nathaniel Craig, and friends, where they use this to try and alleviate the problem, the hierarchy problem for the Higgs. Similarly, another question that was posed to us is like, does the effective field theory break at the Planck scale or break below the Planck scale? Well, that's not an effective field theory question. It's UV sensitive, and it actually doesn't have a universal answer in string theory. As this is another example of using string theory as a laboratory, as a point of principle, one can find string theory vacua where the effective field theory is valid up to Planck, we believe, and others where it breaks down much less. So it also doesn't have a universal answer. But for instance, in swampland, there seems to be a generic feature that whenever you have a small gauge coupling, the UV cutoff of the theory is less than g to the 1/3, and this is related to the distance conjecture. So indeed, there's an expectation from swampland, which might not be what you expect from effective field theory, that small couplings means reduced validity of the EFT regime. So the way I view this is that effective field theory is a very general, super nice framework that can go in many directions, many, many directions. And the role of positivity bounds, swampland, or stuff like anomalies. Like anomalies are, in a sense, they're like the swampland, but in quantum field theory. You just have like a Lagrangian that looks completely fine, and it's actually inconsistent on the quantum level because of an anomaly. So the role of all these three things is to bound a bit the directions in which effective theory can go, and hopefully help us pinpoint where it goes to the real world.
Thank you, Miguel. And now, Carlo.
Me,
follows.
Carlo.
Yes.
Okay, no slides again. This is single slide. I'm the first loop guy here talking. Bialas, Biabai, Bianca, I think there's other things. Let me just add two comments. One is just to frame this within my own perspective about quantum gravity. And the second is specifically about EFT. But I think it's good to give a, since there have been no talk about loops so far, the way I think about it. Let me put it this way. 40 years ago, when I was the age of the young people here, I'm most talking about the young people because the old people already have their own ideas. They're not going to listen to anything else. I would go to conferences, and the problem on the table in gravity was not really, there are just a few, but not really to understanding quantum behavior of gravity. It was just to understand the relativistic behavior of gravity. And the situation was that there were a lot of theories which were studied, a lot of different hypotheses, half-cooked things. There was, of course, general relativity, but there was Brunswick theory, and then there was, I don't know, torsion, high derivatives, Kaluza-Klein, McDowell, Mansouri, supergravity, you name it, long list of. Plus general argument, all this class of things could be that, and I could take all the possibilities. And I remember at the conferences, this was the main topics of the conferences. Then there was a small, relatively smaller group of people who were doing something else. They were taking what seemed to be the best hypothesis, that was general relativity, not only consistent with observation at the time, and Brunswick was equally consistent, but seemed to be the simplest, reasonable, coherent with local Lorentz invariants as basic things, and Newton, and take that theory, study it, apply it to physical situations, stars, cosmology, whatever, test it, even if it seems so incredibly hard to test it. And these people were, for instance, Penrose, Thorne, Peeble, Hulse and Taylor, Permutler, Smith, Rees, Gentz and Goetz, and they all got Nobel Prizes. I think we are very likely that we're in a similar situation, in my opinion, and of course I may be wrong. Namely, there are tentative theories of gravities out there, well-defined in four dimensions, consistent with quantum mechanics, consistent with general relativity, with all sort of incomplete, not well-understand aspect, maybe different options of formulating them, but they are out there. And if you allow me, I have two persons who have been presented as string theorists, one on my right and one on my on my left. There are not many decent theory of gravity out there. I think you can count less than the theory of a hand. And given the what I see, big troubles of string theory recently in experiments and then in delivering what was hoped in the past, loop quantum gravity is at least a very good example of a possible tentative quantum theory of gravity. As I said, not complete, not totally clear, hard to do calculation, but some calculations are done with a lot of effort to apply it to early universe, to black holes, and so on and so forth. So it seems to me that at least a very reasonable thing to do is to just push it, compare it to observation. So that's the framework. Now, from this perspective, what's the relation with effective field theory? I see no convincing argument whatsoever to not think that the theory that John has described this morning is not a good, very good convincing description of gravity. I would be very surprised if an experiment shows it wrong up to some good energy. Very surprised. Now, of course, we don't know. We're scientists. We're open to everything. But we know classical GR. We know quantum mechanics. We know certain aspects of field theory and quantum field theory. That's what we reasonably have to expect. It seems anything else is not convincing to me. At the same time, obviously that theory, John tells that, it goes wrong at some scale. Okay. Now, if you come from loop quantum gravity, you know why, very precisely why. okay? Because quantum gravity is not a quantum theory of a field on a given geometry, it's the quantum theory of geometry itself. And in quantum gravity, you can do a calculation from assumptions, which is basically generativity of quantum mechanics, which is a spectral analysis of a certain operator, and show that the geometry itself has some discrete aspect at some scale that you expect to be the Planck scale, the scale in which you expect this thing to happen. And therefore, the continuity of the geometry on which quantum field theory itself is based just go wrong. So we have a theory that says it goes wrong. Okay? So I would expect that once you go out of the regime of the validity of the theory that John was described, is quantum field theory itself, in the sense of the usual standard quantum field theory, whether on curved space-time or not, that that goes wrong. Now, of course, this means that in quantum gravity, in loop quantum gravity, it's an open problem, and I count this as one of the open problems on which people should work, and there is some work, some initial work in some direction, but not much, to show that the transition amplitude that you can compute in loop quantum gravity, once you go down, once you go at large distances, they start matching the. Now, there is some work on that, especially using the covariant formulation of loop quantum gravity. It's not completely obvious because, of course, you have to to input to the calculation the sort of background Minkowski on which you are working, because you work from the other perspective, right, from the deeply non-perturbative thing where you don't see it well. But there are ways of doing that, so there are calculations in which one can show that one can at least start getting the basic elements, the propagator, the vertex functions. Actual best work in that direction, I would say, are the group of Muxin Han and his collaborators. From there to actually start computing what you next orders. So essentially, you won't get the linear theory, no more than that. Next order, it's hard because the amplitude one has have a lot of extra terms, and one we don't have control of which are big, which are. So that's where I see the situation is. So I would, from my perspective, what is interesting in quantum gravity is take the theories we have, very few theories we have, and just use them to say what happened at the end of the black hole evaporation, what happened at Big Bang, concretely, rather than trying to add ideas, new things, or conjecture. Sorry. take these theories, and in the same way which a main problem was, can we find the classical theory in cell? We have argument that the classical theory is in. We want more. We want not just to find the classical theory, we want to find the full effective field theory, because one of the things that John said this morning is that there is still hanging around the idea that it's impossible to put together quantum and gravity. It's not impossible. It's just it's very possible and very convincing in a rather simply unique way all the way to the Planck scale. So that's how I see the current situation. That's my perspective.
Thank you, Carlo. And now we have Fernando.
I will stay here.
You can stay here, okay.
Okay, so.
You need a pointer.
Switcher.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, so I was a good student, so I didn't have homework. and so.
A bad student.
And. Because of that, I sent it last night, so many of the things I had in the slides have already been said. So my apologies for that. But let me start by thanking the organizers for putting all this group together. I think it's a very nice idea to have dialogues and discussions and so on. We only have to get good things out of this, because in communication, I think it's very important, and we learn from each other. Furthermore, I think we all remember the first conference we went when we were graduate students or postdocs. And this is the first conference I come after retirement. So that sense that I would remember. So let me try to say some things that I wrote last night, trying to follow the instructions. So essentially, I have the same perspective that John presented this morning, and in the sense that the effective field theories are the best way to understand physics. Essentially, we understand by different scales. We that's the way that we have been learning about physics in general. And it is nice to see that the general relativity can be seen as an effective field theory. You can see it in the slides. I cannot see it that well because I don't see that well, that, but I'm sure you can see it there. So the expansion in the Einstein Lagrangian. And, it's a nice example of an effective field theory. You just write rho gr and expand in the perturbation of the metric, and you see that there are corrections suppressed by 1 over M Planck. And the same thing about the standard model. So now it's a big trend within the going beyond the standard model is to treat the standard model as an effective field theory. This SNEFT that people have been is probably the most systematic way to try to learn what will go beyond the standard model. And again, this Weinberg took some leadership in this regard, so you can just classify all the operators of different dimensions, and you have the standard model Lagrangian, including gravity or so, but also you start adding extra terms suppressed by one cutoff scale, which is 1 over m, if I can read correctly here. And then there's a dimension 5, dimension 6, and so on. Of different operators, and we learned a lot from it. Just from writing the operator, dimension 5, there's only one operator, that's the Weinberg operator, that gives you a contribution to neutrino masses. So we can put a bound, what is the effective, what will be the UV completion of the standard model that we will learn from, because there's the term is HH lepton-lepton. So once the Higgs gets FF, that will give a mass to the neutrinos. The neutrinos will not get a mass within the standard model directly. And then that, knowing the bounds on the mass of the neutrinos, we learn what is the scale of this m. And this m is already has to be as high as 10 to the 15 GeV or so. So just by looking at this, we already know that there has to be new physics at 10 to the 15 GeV or so. And the same thing with the dimension 6. There are, I don't know, many operators have classified, actually, there's this Poland classification, or the Warsaw classification, I think. And one of the terms I wrote there, which is just a term, a dimension six operator that gives, that breaks a varying number, for instance. And that you, for constraints of proton decay, you can already guess, get what is the value of this effective mass, cutoff is capital M. And again, you get of the order 10 to the 15, 10 to the 17. So, we learn a lot just by just following this systematic approach towards the standard model. So in that sense, it is very, very, very powerful, and we can help us to go beyond. And I wrote the slides in an opposite way, but in purpose, because just to see that there can be a standard effective field theory within effective field theories. And in particular, in the standard model, the standard model is the UV completion of other effective field theories that were valid at the lower energies. And so you can see here there are the two classical examples from the four-Fermi interactions that you have a point like an interaction in the four-Fermi. The theory was non-renormalizable, and then it was UV completed by just having the standard model by having the W particles being exchanged. So that is the first example, you've seen how the weak interactions understood by Glaser, Weinberg, and Salam explain the four Fermi interactions before. So the good thing is that you can say the Fermi theory was not proper, but it was not wrong because it was just a low energy approximation of the standard model. And the same thing with chiral perturbation theory that had been mentioned this morning a couple of times, where now the degrees of freedom change because now instead of quarks and leptons, you have now the pions, and you can see the pions being as pseudo-Goldstone bosons, and then you can write the effective field theory, and now you know the parameter is the pion decaying constant, and you can learn a lot, essentially, a lot about QCD from this effective field theory already. So essentially, and you can go another step beyond, because you can go do nuclear physics, and in nuclear physics, again, Weinberg came out with a classification of operators to describe effective field theory and nuclear physics, and then things that can be tested experimentally. You could just check each of the Wilsonian coefficients and have predictions that can have been compared with the experiment. So essentially, effective field theories have been extremely successful at any energies, and so in the sense that gives us credibility that we can use it for higher energies. So then this is my last slide. They say 1, 2, 3. So I was a good student, so I did 3. So and something that I always like to emphasize is, and I think John mentioned it, is effective theories carry within themselves their own limitations. So in that sense, we cannot say that effective theories are not correct or something, that just by the same nature of effective theory, we know that they're not valid up to the scale that is being expanded. So in that sense, it is like a very humble theory somehow. They don't pretend to be more than they are. So the sense that they know they are valid, but they know also the regime of validity of the theory. And for gravity, this is at least M. Planck. This scale is M. Planck. And one of the questions that we were asked to address, and this is how much below. So in string theory, we can put it, can be the string scale or the Kaluza-Klein scale, which come out naturally to be smaller than Planck scale because there are factors of the volume of the extra dimensions there. And so that's, of course, can be other scales, but essentially that's something we don't know. There are, in string theory, there are examples where the fundamental scale can be very, very, very small of the electroweak scale or so, or even below. And we don't know. So essentially, it's something that's totally open. And again, addressing some of the questions that we were asked, they said, what is our opinion about positivity bounds and Swan-Blanc conjectures? They're very welcome ideas. I think that they're very well good progress that people can make or have made by just putting all those bounds. I was particularly impressed by the presentation this morning. they can give us an idea about the UV completeness. And of course, they cannot be the whole story. You still need to find the UV completion. So you still have, I mean, they can help us to shape what is the UV complete theory, just put bounds on it. But unfortunately, we cannot just limit it completely to see what is the full theory itself. I give example, but so, in the Swan-Blanc there are very quality of conjectures. Some conjectures are more compelling than others. So in that sense, in the spirit of being debate, I will just state that maybe some conjectures are very well supported by different arguments on from string theory. But others are less, and there's a lot of debate in the community. And I think that's also very positive. I can tell you from my own experience, there's one of the conjectures that I'm not very big fan of it, which is the conjecture against the sitter. And in that sense, we have friendly disagree with Miguel and his collaborators. Probably your collaborators, not you. And in the sense that the claim that the sitter that there is no the sitter space in the theory of quantum gravity is, I would say, too strong a claim. It may be true, but it's too strong a claim, and there is no enough evidence. On the other hand, the arguments that the conjectures that Miguel presented this morning, the weak gravity conjecture, is very, very, very well justified. The absence of global symmetries and so. And the distance conjecture also. I have a small criticism about the distance conjecture also. We, as in string theory, we have been used to have this general expansions, and then we say at some point in some limit, we get tower states becoming light. There are the Kaluza-Klein modes, for instance, or the string modes, depending on which parameter we make small. And so it took, I think, two conjectures to get back to the same conclusion. One is that they're always a tower, and the second one, the only towers are these two, something that we knew already for the last 3 years. But on the other hand, I think it's I mean, it's good that people start giving different perspectives about that. The same thing about the Sitter conjecture, there's the old, what people call the Dine-Sauer problem, which is precisely that the fields run away towards infinity. It has been given new perspective from the Swamlin conjecture, which I actually welcome. And again, in the spirit of a debate, one of the questions that can be raised is if there is actually really a Swamlin. I think there is, but it would be nice to hear later on from Miguel if there is a compelling argument that there has to be there is a Swamlin, because it could be that this argument that you say, oh, it may be that the theory itself can find the problem within the effective field theory itself without going to the UV conclusion. So that's something that it can be questioned. And again, something that I think I like that since I wrote this last night, I didn't coordinate with Miguel, but that was the way that Miguel presented. And I think it's good that people have been talking about the Swamlin conjectures, but it would be interesting to see if other people not doing string theory find those conjectures interesting or relevant for what they are doing. So I think that that's... So let me just finish with one small comment. On the positivity bounds, on general amplitudes and so on, there's a possibility, or, well, a trend of a direction to try to see how much we can learn from the UV complete theory. And that reminds me of the case of the standard model. Because in the standard model, we had that essentially by pure thought, we can get very far. And so by pure thought, we can say, well, the fundamental objects in nature have to be particles, I mean, at low scales, they have to be particles of spin 0, 1 half, 1, and 2, probably 3 halves, but we don't know. Beyond 2, we are in trouble. And in, if there is spin 2, we have only the graviton, which is good. And the only freedom we have is to select, you know, because spin 1 has to have gauge symmetries, and the only freedom we have is to choose the gauge group. And the same thing for spin 1 half, what are the representations? So in that sense, we can get very far, and at the end, before just setting up what are these groups and the representations. So it would be ideal to have that kind of understanding about a UV complete theory. And one of them could be that, so we have the spin 1. Massless spin 1, we know that it has to be a case theory. Massive spin 1, you have this perturbative unitarity problem. And then the perturbative unitarity, you solve it by having a Higgs, and then you have the Higgs to understand what. That. So what about spin 2? If spin 2, you have what kind of problem we have there, and what will be the way to make it work? So I think we can be probably more ambitious to try to guess as much as possible the structure of the UV complete theory in this spirit. So I think that could be some of the questions that maybe Andrew can address. Okay, thank you.
My microphone, okay. Thanks, Fernando, and thanks to all of you, because you, for your opening statement, you all raised very, very interesting points. There are a number of things that we could discuss, so maybe let's start from interplay between positivity bounds and Swamlin conjectures. So as Fernando mentioned, I mean, all of these type of constraints are obviously very welcome if one can show have arguments why this should generally hold, especially independent of the specific ultraviolet completion. There can be, as both Miguel and Andrew mentioned, there can be interplay between Swamlin and positivity bounds, which would be very interesting. But at the same time, there are limitations. So for instance, John mentioned, causality in some form could break down at the Planck scale. How would that impact these constraints? Or there are different types of Swamlin conjectures, as Fernando mentioned. So some might be stronger than others, could be, say, independent of the specific ultraviolet completion. Others, as Miguel mentioned also this morning, really depend or are inspired by string constructions, so they are, it is not clear that they would apply generally to other approaches to quantum gravity. And also, I mean, clearly there are also viewpoints that don't start from the quantum field theory, but rather from the geometry, from general relativity, such as loop quantum gravity, and perhaps the discreteness and the features of the theory at high energy can impact, in a sense, positivity bounds, but also some of the Swan-Planck conjecture. So, for instance, the weak gravity conjecture, which is to be believed to be more solid than others. So perhaps we can start discussing the validity of these constraints, also in relation with discreteness and the hypothesis, the assumptions that one makes in the ultraviolet. Does anyone wants to start?
So just to follow up on something Fernando said, which is there really a swamp plan? So there's a perspective that could you see that there's a problem already with the effective field theory that you just hadn't identified? And so I mentioned that because with some of these positivity bounds, we can actually the way they're derived is using analyticity and the assumption about UV and so on. But as I showed at the end of my talk, that some of the positivity bounds you can actually just infer just from a direct, simple, low-energy causality argument. So you can, within the EFT, you can construct background solutions that you trust within the EFT, and you find that you have macroscopic violation of causality. So not a microscopic one, but a macroscopic one, so something that you could observe. And so if you demand that that doesn't occur, that puts a constraint on the EFT, which actually matches reasonably well with what you infer from positivity bounds. So there is a take on that, that in that example, the positivity bounds are just deriving for you something that you could have inferred directly from the EFT. However, I have to say that when you actually do it, the positivity bounds is much cleaner, quicker, and better. Because when you run the argument as a causality one, you have to, it's a bit more fudgy because you have to push your solution so that it's basically to make the EFT background interesting, you have to make things close to the cutoff, but you can't go too far. And so you have to play this game. Whereas the positivity bounds is a clean mathematical statement. So even if you could say you could reproduce all the constraints by just analyzing the low energy theory, at a pragmatic level, these approaches are actually a more elegant way to derive results and much faster.
If I could comment on that a bit. So I mean, just to the same point. So I can certainly give you examples where there's no known way to derive some Swan-Planck constraints from low energy effective theory. For instance, these constraints on the rank of the theories with 16 supercharges, there's no known way. Right? I don't know of any example where you can actually prove that it cannot be obtained somehow from effective theory methods, except for those Swan-Planck constraints that tell you something which is almost by construction not part of the effective theory. So for instance, there's sometimes Swan-Planck constraints like variants of this thing called the completeness principle, which tells you must have all possible charges in your theory, okay? There's variants of this, another one is called the cobordism conjecture. And this, for instance, they can be used to predict new non-perturbative objects in any quantum theory of gravity. So the idea is if you have a quantum theory of gravity with this or that property, you know, there's new objects. And those are almost by construction. Well, they are by construction outside of the effective field theory, so that clearly is not going to be captured by the effective field theory. I think, like, to connect with you know, with positivity and stuff, I guess also with something that you said during your remarks now, is in a sense, like, the more interesting Swan-Planck constraints, right? Things, you know, like things about just like the Lagrangian couplings, like the weak gravity conjecture, right? They are about the relevant couplings in the Lagrangian, and those are harder to get, I guess, with positivity. Do you see any, you know, how do you see that evolving down the road? Do you think it's going to be likely that we can get stuff like that? Or even, you know, like even at a zeroth order level, something like constraints on the number of fields. Do you think it's in the horizon that we can prove with positivity or with, you know, just effectively through methods, you know, and some UB assumptions, as you were explaining, that, I don't know, like you cannot couple a million scalar fields to gravity or something crazy like that?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, as you say, the people have made attempts to get the weak gravity conjecture from positivity bounds, and it kind of works like about 90%, but it's not a proof. But just because of the way the arguments work, it's quite plausible that that could be filled in. We just haven't phrased it the right way. I think the constraints on number of fields, right? There's the old statement that if you have n fields, the cutoff is really n Planck over root n, yeah. And that, you know, there's extremely naive, simple EFT arguments for that.
Yeah.
And I think also if you spell that out, you could very easily spell that out a bit more precisely through a positivity type, unitarity type argument.
I understand. I'm familiar with those. What I mean is, like, you know, in string theory, nobody has ever been able to get your string compactification with a trillion scalar fields, like in the massive scalar fields. So Fernando was explaining, you get many scalar fields, but many is like 100 or 1,000 tops, 10,000 in some crazy example. You never get to a trillion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's something I find interesting. Just a deep IR, sort of.
I think Carlo wanted to comment on that, right?
Yeah, just hearing you talking, I want to make a general point. We're talking about quantum gravity, and somehow the specific quantum gravity seems that strings and loops are two different possible solutions to the same problem. But these theories were not born in that sense. I think that the difference between the sort of the, at least historic evolution, but is still in the mind frame of most people of the two community, is that there wasn't a common problem, but two different problems. And within one, you might or not say something about the other. One problem is unification, essentially. I mean, can we write a theory of everything? Can we write a theory to describe everything? Yeah. So there was this big excitement because, you know, string, you expand, you find this and this and that, you verify the graviton. So the driving force behind string theory is always being, can we find a theory of everything, seems to me. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's less interesting. String theory is just a piece of something else. I mean, just this. So it's a community that identified as a fruitful scientific problem on which to work to find the theory of everything. Loop quantum gravity, not just loop quantum gravity, I mean other approaches to quantum gravity, have a different perspective, which is, you know, we didn't understand, when I was young, we didn't understand the strong interactions or the hadrons, and there were people who were saying, well, you can only understand this if you also understand that and that and that. And no, it turned out that there is a quantum field theory for the strong interaction that seemed to work fantastically well, as far as we understand, which is QCD. And even QED by itself worked well up to some point, and Langlois-Salam works well. These are not unified theory. These are. So it's a specific physical problem is what are the quantum properties of space and time, or what happened at the end of the evaporation of black hole, or what is a. So this is identification of different problems. So if you come from this perspective, it sounds less interesting to say what I can couple to gravity. Yeah. Well, just write a quantum theory of gravity, and then you want a quantum theory of gravity that is coherent with the rest, that can couple to that. Well, you want a QCD that you can couple to Langlois-Salam. You don't want a QCD by itself. Okay, so you want a quantum theory of gravity you can couple with the standard model. But then you say, what about the theory of everything? Well, let's leave that to our grandchildren.
But then let me ask, because so to me,
not criticism, it's pointing out that there's two different mindsets.
So for me, yeah, but I feel about this mindset kind of strongly. And to me, the motivation is the equivalence principle, right? So, you know, for QCD or for any other quantum field theory, it makes sense to decouple it from the other stuff. So you can have a quantum field theory for one sector, not for the other. But the equivalence principle tells you that matter couples to gravity.
It does.
And the moment that you have, you know, loops of matter, they're going to affect your theory of gravity. So to me, that's why I agree, it's a philosophical question.
They do.
It's not possible, you know, it's conceptually possible that you can treat the two things separately. But philosophically, it makes a lot of sense to me to have to treat the two of them together simply because they will talk via loops, because it's a quantum theory of gravity, and so matter loops will matter.
Mm-hmm. And maybe Fernando wanted to add
something. Just to say, yeah. The same of the, I mean, take the standard model, the Langlois-Salam theory is it's a consistent theory of the weak interaction. It doesn't change the fact that the electron or interact with the proton interact, and vice versa. QCD is a well. So I'm not saying we necessarily need a theory just gravity by itself. What about the theory just gravity itself? Which in loop quantum gravity, you can add protons, electrons, fermions without any problem, and Young-Mills fields, which is a different idea that gravity is going to be consistent only if. I understand the reason, I mean, the historical reason. For instance, supergravity, you have the gravitino and the graviton, but the opposite sign in the loops, so they seem to cancel each other divergences. So there was this trend, this push, these motivations. But I think it remains a different problem. Is there a description of a quantum gravitational phenomena where gravity is irrespectively of what specific kind of matter?
So maybe
Fernando, yes.
Yes, just going back to your point before, so 4 years ago, you were going to GR conferences, and I was going to grand unification conferences. So, and the topics were Pascalid unification, the hierarchy problem, the SU5 or SL10.
Of course,
and that was good. Exactly, there were different communities. And I think it's a sign of progress that we are all talking together now. So in that sense, we are addressing the big questions. But I can tell you, precisely because of that, my motivation to do string theory was, as you say, that to find a fundamental theory of all interactions, because that was my interest. Is gravity was okay because we didn't understand, but it was gravity with the whole picture, with the whole together.
But SU5 was a tragedy, do you agree?
Yes, no, I think so. So now, but I think all of this is progress because we are learning more. For instance, at that time, we believed, or people believed, that SU5 was the, you know, it's unique, it was a big progress. From at that time is George and Glashow, as compared to the Patti-Salam model. Patti-Salam model, people didn't consider that interesting because it was not a simple group. It was SU4 versus SU2. It was a complicated thing. But on the other hand, you look backwards. And that paper actually is someone reminded me that it is the first paper of the physics beyond the standard model. And that's what they predicted, that proton decay, number of violations. So. But at that time, we were just too much fixed on the simple groups, and the SU5, and then progress was SO10. And also now, from a string theory, having a simple group is not precisely what we needed. But so in that sense, it's good that we have now two communities discussing the same things, I agree with Carlo. Believe it or not, that it is important to ask now the phenomenological questions. So you have your preferred theory, we have our preferred theory, and try to explore as much as possible what is it that we can learn from it that can eventually be measured experimentally in the near future or in the long future. So in that sense, it's something that we have to address. And we will learn more by contrasting things with experiment. So,
John wants to comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to take the discussion a little bit of a different direction. I'd like to ask Carlo in particular to talk about black hole evaporation and remnants, because this is one where we've heard that there could be profound implications for our low energy theories, no global symmetries. Yet when I look at the papers about lack of remnants, it seems to be pretty hand waving to me. And I know Carlo has thought more deeply than I have about it, so I'd like to ask Carlo's comments on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, John. Let me put it this way. First, just connecting to your last words, here is a problem which I think everybody doing quantum gravity should ask. What is my theory telling me about what happened at the end of the Hawking evaporation? right? So we all know a big black hole, if I'm just outside the horizon, the curvature is small. A small black hole just outside the horizon, the curvature is large. In fact, goes 1 over the radius, Schwarzschild radius when it goes down. So that means that when we all consider Hawking evaporation very, very credible, very reasonable, not sure, but very reasonable. So that means that when the black hole is small, outside, we're in a deep quantum regime. Outside, not inside. So whatever we're going to see after that, it depends on quantum gravity. Cannot be said, well, we're outside. So that's first message. We should all study that. Now, there are 3 things that might happen, which are in the literature considered. One is that the big interior, which is still there, when the bottleneck is small, the interior is still large in classical GR, the big interior becomes another disconnected asymptotic region. Okay, that's one possibility. It doesn't seem very plausible to me. Some people have been considering that. It seems very implausible to the string people because the string people look at them from the outside, so they don't want another asymptotic region. So let me discard this one for a moment. Then there are 2 possibilities. One is that the black hole shrinks to 0, disappears, and the interior disappears. Okay. And that, of course, creates the black hole information problem. And so you have to find ways to bring the information out before. Some funny way to have, you know, page curve coming down, and, you know, early Hawking quanta. What I want to stress is that this idea that the bottleneck, the horizon shrinks to 0, Yuri Minkowski, and the interior disappears, it's an hypothesis about quantum gravity, which I haven't seen any calculation supporting this hypothesis, not even a vague calculation supporting this hypothesis. So if there is one, usually it's just assumed. If this is a macroscopic geometry, then the horizon is an event horizon, because the inside of black hole is not seen from null infinity, okay? The other possibility, which is a possibility which I've been exploring, other people have been exploring, it's an old idea, Abai has an old paper suggesting something like that, is that there's no event horizon. Namely, from the outside, from the inside, you can come out after the end of the evaporation. So you have a remnant, or you have something that remains after the I've been working on the semi-classical description of what is after as a white hole, because you can view this as a bounce, and it's a white hole hypothesis. And you can do some calculation in loop quantum gravity, very tentative, very approximate, in which you do the quantum transition from the classical part to, again, the classical part through the quantum, so the quantum tunneling through the quantum region in this compact region of space-time. So if this is reasonable, and if there's this remnant, so the classical picture of a remnant is a small horizon, if you want a white hole horizon. This is approximative, don't take it. I'm cutting all sorts of details here. With a huge interior. Then the theory should include the possibility that there are stable or semi-stable, because this might have a long states, at the Planck scale, which isn't too absurd. Right here we have a quantum gravity of a theory with a scale. It's not absurd that in the spectrum, I don't know, I'm just throwing things there, in the spectrum of the theory there are some long-living states at the scale of the theory. That's a remnant hypothesis. I've been working on this with many collaborators. I think there is one poster outside on black hole on that. And let me just add one thing. This is just a wild speculation, so tell it that if there are many small little thing, Planck scale is a weight of my hair, right? A microgram, a fraction of a microgram, floating around in the universe for some reason, that's at present is a perfect candidate for dark matter. Mm-hmm. So that would be the secret hope. There are all sorts of open problems here, cosmology, I don't want to go into that. So that idea, that there could be in the theory some possible states which can come up as remnant of black holes, which are around the Planck mass, and which are semi-stable.
Yeah, so let me just have something. So that is a very interesting point and viewpoint, but we will also cover this in detail in the next days, because there will be panel discussions deeper on quantum gravity and black holes, particularly. Going back to the discussion, on the, I think Miguel wanted to quickly follow up, but then I also think that the question of evaporation is really deep into quantum gravity, and it is beyond the regime of what effective field theory can say, in particular because in black hole physics there are horizons and well, the interplay...
There is an open question, maybe that's what John was... which is, in the context of effective theory, could there be a small thing at this mass, which is low from the astrophysical perspective, but high from the particle physics perspective? Is that consistent with the rest of the picture? That seems to me one open question. I don't know how to answer that.
Miguel, I
wanted to follow up on what you said and ask a question, which is, so I completely agree. I think, in fact, you know, in string theory or, you know, in concrete, the examples that we control the best, like in holography, you know, in ADS 5 versus 5, it's certainly true you get a bunch of states at around M Planck, and they're stable, but it's this is like an upper bound on the number of such states that you get. And, you know, for all the, you know, all the heuristic connections to no global symmetries and that kind of thing, the problem is not to have remnants or to have, you know, a bunch of them and which are like metastable. The problem is when you really have, which is what you can argue you have when you have a global symmetry, you have like an infinite number of those and they're all mass degenerate and they're exactly stable. So it's like the extreme version of it that can give, you know, that's all you need to get in trouble with the no global symmetry story. But what I wanted to, you know, to ask is, like, do you envision, like, when you have this picture of remnants, you have any guess or idea of how many of those?
Yes.
Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Well, first, they're not stable.
Yeah, they're long lived.
Yeah. Because the classical picture right. is that you can use Einstein equation to evolve a small bottle horizon with a big inside, and then everything comes out. So information comes out, takes a long time.
So that sounds like a hint that symmetries are being broken there, because if any of those states have a global charge, they could not decay to the vacuum. If they are really long-lived metastable, suggests that they don't carry any conserved charges.
That I don't know. That I wouldn't know how to reply. How many they are there, it's easy to estimate if you take the hypothesis of dark matter seriously.
I see what you mean. Yes.
Because we know how much dark matter there is, exactly. Well, exactly, within the order of magnitude, and we know the mass of this. So I can tell you in this room there's one going by every 6 months.
I mean, how many different species, like how many different kinds of black hole microstates would you have? And I guess that wouldn't come out directly from the dark matter density, right?
You have one if you think that this is an object, but it's characterized by a large number of quantum numbers. So there's many more quantum numbers than just its size, mass, because you want the full entropy, you want to store the full entropy of black hole, right? So you want the inside.
Oh, okay, so they have as
there
many
is all whatever is full inside, including the patterns of the Hawking radiation, perhaps, or whatever came in.
Thanks.
Okay, so at this point, so unless we have a very quick follow-up, the idea of the discussion was really trying to understand the pinpoint what are the constraints on quantum gravity that one should have at low energies. And we are, of course, understanding that there are maybe some Swan-Planck conjectures that are more stable than others, but even with the weak gravity conjecture might require some inputs from ultraviolet physics. And maybe one question for Andrew, maybe also John, would be what are the ultraviolet details that could impact, for instance, positivity bounds or one loop computations? So for instance, if one has fundamental discreteness or no new degrees of freedom, how would these constraints be affected? Or do you think they are valid independent of what the ultraviolet details are?
I think there are ways in principle to violate some of these. And my favorite will be talked about a bit by Bob Holden later, which is a theory, the theory with higher derivatives, quadratic gravity, which does violate the causality conditions, probably lives in the swampland by standard definition. But aside from the violation of causality on short scales, may otherwise form an acceptable theory. So it violates some of the conditions. It may not, I mean, it's still a bit of an open question whether it's totally fatal in the end, but at the moment, the signs are pointing towards it being an acceptable otherwise theory on long distance scales, but it does violate, it lives in the swampland, lives in the antipositive, the negativity.
So there's violation of causality at very, very long wavelength.
Oh, no, very short. Short wavelengths.
And then somehow that disappears in the deep IR.
So it's basically, it's governed by time scales of order the Planck scale.
Yes.
But it's the net effect of that is one of the coefficients carries different signs than Andrew would have normally liked.
I see.
And probably you would like. I think it's probably in your swampland.
It would be very interesting to quantify exactly what would.
Right.
And so maybe do you want to follow up? So in particular, so for instance, this morning you mentioned that some of the positivity bounds are about relationship between irrelevant parameters in the action, right? And one question could be like, if you have a theory which is discrete and not continuum, how do you define the irrelevant parameters, and would you have the same relationship between the same positivity bounds?
Yeah, so I think, going back to the same points before, there's a whole set of assumptions that go into all these things. The only one I wouldn't give up is unitarity, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to the statement that I think most of us here still think quantum mechanics isn't the thing you adjust. But all the other ones, it's a matter of taste which one you might give up on. Just again, hasn't been a lot of mention of sort of IR extensions or IR modifications, but there are a whole class of IR modifications that people thought about, which do violate positivity bounds because they just work completely differently. And it may just be that those particular theories have a UV completion that's just completely different. Going back to old ideas of the DGP model and so on, that was the perspective at the time that it was accepted that they didn't respect the positivity bounds and that just the UV completion was different. And for example, Dvalli has a paper on, I think, titled Signs for UV Completion, which is basically amounting to saying if the sign is one way, then the UV completion goes this way, if it's the other way, it goes that way. And you could just read these statements in reverse, which is that if your low energy theory violates the positivity bound, then it means its UV completion can't be local, Rontgen, Rontgen, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean it doesn't have one. It just means it can't be one of those things. And I think that's the legalistic way to read these statements. So, as I say, the only thing I wouldn't give up is unitarity.
Okay, thank you. So I think this is a good point to open the discussion to the audience. So are there any questions from the audience? Renate.
In your face. Just to take a bit of a contrarian point of view, I would say, the initial question that was on the board was, right, constraints on quantum gravity. I mean, how much of EFT should we expect to be able to reproduce? I would say, strictly speaking, nothing we haven't confirmed by experiments. So, I mean, I would say even nothing beyond classicality. Of course, classicality is mixed in some of these, expansions, as John explained to us this morning. But everything beyond, I think, we may not have to reproduce it.
Carlo, I think, wants to comment on that.
Yes, I think Renata has a point here, and I just wanted to I agree with Renata. I just wanted to maybe see if you agree. It makes perfectly sense to do theoretical work saying, if I assume this and this and this, because I think it's reasonable that this happened for one reason or the other, these are the constraints that follow. And this is essentially what you want from a theoretician, right? To do this cleanly and well. Then you can interpret in different manners. One is that, oh, I get some constraints, I should stay within this constraint. Another is maybe I don't want to stay in this constraint because, but I know that if I don't stay in this constraint, I'm violating one of my hypotheses. Mm-hmm. Okay. So both logics are fine, are exactly fine. It came out well from your talk. If instead the question is formulated, are there things that a quantum gravity should satisfy, just myself, I think that the clean answer is level zero, exactly what Renate was saying. No, we should just have a theory that we expect that has a regime which where it fits with the theories that are confirmed in that regime. Nothing else. That's the only thing we want from it. And second level, we might want something more because we might think that within the theories we have, there are some general principles which we expect to be conserved. Right, mm-hmm. And that's again being a good theoretical physicist, but careful because it's exactly the choice of which principle to be conserved that is crucial. When you say unitarity, for instance, unitarity in the way I think you mean it, it depends on two things: one, conservation of probability that is needed for consistency, and two, the existence of a one-parameter family of transformation which I interpret as time, which it's well-defined on the full field space of the theory. So, for instance, in the hypothesis, which I don't consider probable, in which the black hole goes to a different asymptotic region, no surprise if there's no unitarity in some. So even these kind of things one should take with. That's why I think the overall attitude, it's within theories that there are constraints. But among theories, no. I mean, the theory is coherent, consistent. Is this a good theory of quantum gravity or not? That's the right question.
But, sorry, Gallo, surely there's universal things. For instance, we would, you know, in the situation you were just describing, where the black hole pinches off, goes to a different asymptotic region, a full quantum theory of gravity should be able to tell us what's the amplitude for that. Should be able to tell us. Should be fully unitary if you include all these connected components.
Yeah, but that's not the unitary that you're
referring to. Yeah, yeah. No, but you know, unitarity in the sense that in some appropriate sense probabilities add up to one is something that we want for sure. Another thing that we want of anything that is, I don't know, it's a matter of definition at some point. But for me, to call something a quantum theory of gravity is any quantum mechanical model, which at low energies reproduces a massless spin to excitation, because that's what we're talking about, that's the graviton, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting that, you know, within large classes of models that have these things, there seem to be, like, you know, very general patterns, even in models which are very different from each other, and that you can argue kind of generally. So I completely agree with you that you need to define, like, what are your assumptions. It's super important, actually, to say exactly what do you mean, where is it coming from, right? But, and actually, you know, like, to say that out loud is probably good, because then we can have this conversation. For instance, like, to me, the idea that there's, like, an infinite number of remnants, you know, on a quantum gravity seems bizarre because of unitarity and so on and so forth. And for instance, I just learned that the remnants you were talking about, there's a finite number of them, they're metastable, so you're actually completely fine with this kind of principle. So
we will come back to this question in the next days.
Yes.
So there is a question again.
So it's the effective theory of gravity that predicts the black hole. So how do you know that the full theory of gravity won't predict something that replaces the black hole?
I didn't get it. How do you know that the full theory of gravity
would predict something else that looks like a black hole but actually replaces the black hole?
Something that looks like the black hole in some limit but it really isn't, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, you know, I would say that black hole is a solution of GR, so any UV completion of that is not going to be exactly the, you know, the black hole. Like, for instance, in ADS-CFT, the way you describe the black hole is like you have a bunch of microstates satisfy against the thermalization hypothesis, and you kind of like believe that at low energies in some regime that behaves like a diffuse black hole, or there's the whole fuzzball proposal, or what Carlo was mentioning. Those are all scenarios in which there's no actual black hole. From the point of view of Swampland, at least, all that matters is that in the deep IR, it kind of behaves like a black hole. It evaporates like a black hole, you know.
Are you saying it has to have a horizon, though?
So, you know, if, for instance, for the weak gravity conjecture, for instance, you know, there's this argument which is related to whether black holes evaporate. It's not really going to matter whether the black hole really has a horizon or not, but it's going to matter that the near that there's a sort of like a near horizon geometry where you can analyze things with the Schwinger effect, or there's things like Hawking evaporation. So that's the piece that you need. If you are able to have Hawking evaporation without the horizon, then, for instance, then a lot of it would follow, I would say.
Yeah. So in relation with Carlos' comment, yeah, it is true that in the end, what we observe at low energies or what the quantum gravity gives, of course, it will, in a sense, depend on the ultraviolet completion. But the idea of effective field theory is really to try to, under, at least it is an attempt, and also the Swampland program, to see if there are any universal features that we would expect, at least. Of course, they could break down, but they could still hold for any approach. And so one of these things that emerge from quantum field theory calculations is one-loop corrections to general relativity. In connection to Renate's point that, well, in the end, we should see what we measure, what we observe, and if that is it. So now I would like to ask to John, would you expect corrections to general relativity computed with effective field theory or quantum field, low energy quantum field theory method to hold, or could they break down, and how?
They break down at short distance. So the the corrections that I showed you were all power laws. They're power laws until they break down. There will be a time when they break down. But it, at least for these particular observables, it should be at short distance scales. And so, but as has been mentioned, that the effective field theory itself doesn't predict where that is. It's the effective field theory is a framework that we may be able to put an upper bound on where it should break down, but it's easy to break down at energy scales below that, and it would be fascinating if it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, there's one place where we do quantum effective field theories of gravity every day, which is in cosmology when we do the calculation of inflationary perturbations. That is a quantum calculation. If you treated the background classically and just looked at the inflaton as a scalar on that fixed background, you'd get the wrong answer. There is a non-trivial mixing between the inflaton and the gravity sector that you have to account for and treat it as an EFT. And our current understanding is, you know, if you believe in inflation, but even the alternatives work on the same principle, you know, the entire large-scale structure of the universe comes from these quantum fluctuations through a calculation that we can actually do. Now, at leading order, that's a tree-level calculation, but people can and do calculate the loop corrections to that, and they're small, and that's consistent with observations. But that is, if there's any calculation which is immediate, in which you might see the influence of any departure from the EFT gravity framework, that's the most likely one, I would say, because it is a calculation we have to do to predict real physics.
Continuing maybe on that point, yes, Fernando, maybe
can
you
can... ask a question No, I wanted to ask a question, just probably moving a little bit away from what we were discussing, but it was, when you were talking. Remember there was this paper of Malacena and Edelstein and other people about higher powers on R and the coefficient, you have to be positive or negative to make the theory consistent. And that required tower of states or something. That was a very concrete, probably you remember.
Sorry, what was that?
It's Mandelson and Edelstein and other people. I think they were computing an effective theory, the R cube or something.
Yes.
Term. And then the coefficient being positive was important, important for consistency, and they concluded that you have to have
That's right. So I think you're referring to the statement when you have, if you have higher curvature terms in the EFT, you need to argue you need an infinite tower of spins. Is that the argument
you're
referring to? Yeah. So in some sense, that's an old that's a rephrasing of an old argument. So if you assume your theory is weakly coupled.
Mm-hmm.
So by that we mean that let's just look at the tree level scattering amplitudes. Then the problem that comes from gravity is that you get this T-channel pole whose residue goes like S squared, and that violates these assumptions about the growth of the amplitude and so on. And so you need, basically the argument is the only way to resolve that is to start adding, is to imagine that what you have is a series where you have an S cubed and then an S to four and so on, but it can't truncate at any order. So you have to have an infinite number of terms so that pathologically large S growth gets resummed into some completely different behavior. But it could never occur from a finite number of terms. Now essentially each exchange massive spin state just gives you a polynomial in powers of S. So any finite number of spin states can't possibly UV complete gravity in a weakly coupled way. So you need some function that, you know, starts growing, but then turns over to satisfy various bounds on the growth regi kind of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you need an infinite tower of spin states in a weakly coupled theory. And string theory, of course, does that.
Right. There could be, can you see, it's how... How important is the conclusion that, so that means that you have to always have an infinite number of states?
Again, sorry.
The conclusion is that you, independent of the string theory, is that you will always need an infinite tower of states?
But that comes from weak coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it comes from basically, I mean, and again, it goes back to Veneziano. You ask, if you're just writing down a tree level amplitude with only poles,
mm-hmm.
and you ask how I can write down something that's consistent with all expectations at high energies but matches the low energy, you need an infinite number of poles when it's gravity. But when you don't have gravity, because spin one, you don't get the problem because it's not S squared, it's S, and so it's fine.
Okay. So there is one last comment by Miguel that he promised to be very, very short.
Yeah, I promise it's very short. I just wanted to, because... I wanted to comment on some of the things that Fernando mentioned on Swampland. And for instance, you were mentioning the De Sitter conjecture.
Yes.
The conjecture is not that there's no De Sitter, it's that there's no De Sitter in the syntotic regions of modelized space. I think everybody, I don't know anybody in Swampland who thinks there's no De Sitter anywhere in modelized space. And you were mentioning also the
But the constraints, it was derivative of the volume, but derivative of the potential.
Yeah, asymptotically in modelized space.
Yes. But
in the bulk, for instance.
Well, I have heard talks.
Sir?
I have heard many talks, people. So this, we can only say now asymptotically, but. And then, so the but was never complete. But.
So the other point I wanted to mention is with the distance conjecture, you were saying like it's we know that there's always like the compactification and perturbative string limit. That is really, that is really amazing. So the thing that has changed from the 80s to now is that now we were able to explore many, many more limits in modelized space. It is really crazy that whenever you take a weird Calabi-Yau, you compactify it in a weird point in modelized space that nobody, knew how to do in the 80s has been learned recently, actually. Now, you know, when you go through that limit, there's still, again, the compactification and the Petrov string. That's really good. Okay. And that, I just wanted to clarify that that's the development respect to the AI.
So since we are running out of time, I would say, this is a very interesting discussion, but there will be also a cosmological puzzles panel discussion. I'm sure that there we can continue also on this topic. And so I would go in the direction of closing this panel, also because there is the welcome reception that is waiting all of us. In the spirit of the conference, I would like to ask all of the panelists to give one closing statement, short one, very short, in the light of the panel discussion. So you can think about it. Maybe the first one who is ready can speak up.
Wow, it took up a surprise. So shall I start?
Yes. Can start.
Any other volunteer? No. No, I think, as I said before, I think it's wonderful to have this discussion. The good thing is that we are all asking the relevant questions that we all consider are important, and we have different approaches, which I think is very healthy. We agree or disagree on how things go. So in that sense, it is good that we meet. There are issues among different approaches. I have my criticism to the landscape. I may not totally agree with the comparison with loop quantum gravity and string theory. In particular, I missed asking Carlo what you think about the weak gravity conjecture in your approach, because in string theory you can think that you can decouple gravity, and that makes sense because it's the weakest theory. Is the weakest couple theory. So the other approach, can you decouple other fields, other interactions and keep gravity? And but for John, I have to say, I don't disagree at all. I don't have any questions to ask you because I think I fully agree with you. And Andrew, I asked already my questions, which I think things are in the right, interesting direction, but of course there is a limitation. So that's it. So I think that I'm pleased to be part of this group, of this panel. Thank you for inviting me. But I think it's we are all very civilized, and we are all agreeing to disagree.
Okay. So. Next, Carlo, and try to stay within 1-2 sentences.
Okay, one sentence to answer your question. I don't know. I've been puzzled by that, and I'm asking that to myself. I didn't get to an answer. And the second thing, I would say that compute what happened at the end of the evaporation of black hole. It's an invitation to everybody, and especially, you've repeated many times that you have 10 to a zillion theories of quantum gravity. Just pick one, whatever you want, and use it one to compute what happened at the at the end of the evaporation of that hole, and then we compare notes.
Is 8 as factor as 5 good for you?
Whatever you want.
I think in that one we can't know.
Okay. And then Miguel, next, also two sentences.
Yeah, I just want to say that I don't usually, this is the first time I go to a conference which is this broad, and it's absolutely awesome to talk to all of you. I already have like more questions after each talk than I have on average, which is great, so just thanks to everybody for that.
I've enjoyed listening to people's comments, and I really enjoy the frankness which everyone discusses their own work with. I always try to take away from each conference something that I find particularly urgent, and I think the thing I've come away with is this debate here about black hole endpoints as a particularly urgent question for the structure of low energy theories. So that's my takeaway.
So I would say, I don't think I'm very old, but I'm old enough to remember when cosmologists would write down models that, if you thought about it, would have huge quantum corrections and become unstable. And they wouldn't worry about it because they would say, oh, we don't know how to quantize gravity, so I don't have to bother about that. And I think the recognition by people working in gravity and cosmology that you can use effective field theory methods. It's actually only fairly recent, because it wasn't the case when I started my PhD. And I still think it is an important technique. And now we discard a lot of models. So you can ask whether we can observe quantum gravity, but actually we throw away a lot of cosmological models now because we understand better how we should think of them at the quantum level. And so EFT techniques in gravitational theories really are useful in distinguishing theories.
Okay, I think this was a really great discussion, so let's thank the panelists.